From WSKG Public Radio, this is a special edition of Off the Page.
Has anyone here seen my old friend? He used to play guitar. He had the style, he had the heart. He could have been better than most of them, but he never made the stars.
This song is called One More Broken Thing, and it's written and performed by Dave Elder. Dave is from Vestal, New York. He's now in his early 60s and hasn't always had an easy life as the middle one of three sons of parents who couldn't care for him well. But Dave did go to college, he worked as a musician, and observed but did not become part of the drug scene, lived in California and New York City. And all this time, his life was shadowed by his mother's mental illness. He's written about it in a new autobiographical work entitled Expecting the Broken Brain to Do Mental Push-Ups, a Personal Journey to Understanding Schizophrenia and Depression. And Dave Elder is with us. Welcome to Off the Page.
Oh, thank you.
And also with us today is Dr. Edward Major, a practicing psychiatrist in Binghamton for over 40 years, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to participate.
And I've got to ask Dave about this personal journey, because along the way, did anybody really explain to you exactly what was going wrong with your mother? Because the onset, you were a very, very young child.
Yes.
When all of this began. How did people explain it to you, if they did?
Well, they did and they didn't. I would get bits of information going along, but as a child, I wasn't, you know, the doctors were primarily speaking to my parents, and I didn't necessarily ask. It was like the information kind of filtered down, but not very well.
What is it then that you may have observed as a child that said there's something wrong with Mom?
Well, it was just, you know, there were odd behaviors. There were different things that would happen, and but since I was not an adult, I was not in charge, and we lived with the couple who had raised my mother. They had adopted her, and so my father or the grandfather, the grandmother, you know, whoever was involved at the time, they'd be like, oh, okay, you know, it's time to take her up to the state hospital, or time, you know, that, you know, something's going wrong, and we have to take her to see the doctors.
You do describe in your book an incident where your father says to you that, you know, we've got to get her to the hospital, and you're the one who somehow had to lure her into the car.
Yes, yeah. Well, that was when I was in high school, and due partly at least to her illness, there were times when she didn't necessarily trust my father. And I think this is probably somewhat typical of people with schizophrenia, that they can be paranoid. And she suspected at times that my father was having an affair with the grandmother. Now I don't know at all if that was even possible or not. I mean, it seems impossible.
It sounds like a kind of outlandish idea that you would expect from someone who did have some form of mental illness. But the thing is, though, you had to bring her to the mental hospital.
Right. It
did she know where she was going? Did she know where she was?
Yes, she knew where she was going. She basically, my role in the scene was to persuade her that it was a good thing for her to do.
Yeah. But because then for how long would she be there?
She was there for several weeks.
That is bad. Let me ask Dr. Major, and this may all sound very familiar to you, about the way people who are suffering from schizophrenia may be able to act. Is there any way that you can train the family to be the caregiver when something goes wrong, when some sort of episode happens?
Well, what happens, and you just described it, is Dad would get very frustrated. He would be part of her problem, and then he would have no access to be able to help her. He would get frustrated, and as frustrated, he would be negative, and the negativity is then perceived by her maybe in a paranoid way.
Right.
And of course, he didn't understand. Mm-hmm. But he also didn't try to understand, because it was perceived as not understandable.
Right.
Exactly. This, I think, is maybe the main point, that
yes.
if the medical people don't quite understand, how will the family be able to mm-hmm. deal with that? I mean, did you ever, as you got older, go ask questions of the doctors, of the people who were trying to take care of her?
Well, what it was is that when I left home for college, I was no longer involved with the family. You know, we kept in touch, and I would come back and visit now and then. You know, they were still my family, but I was involved in pursuing my own life, whatever, you know, I wanted to.
And that's
good.
I mean, that you could do that.
Right. And my father was basically looking after my mother. And then what happened, as I mentioned in the book, was that, I was living in California for a while, and then in the late 80s, I decided to come back here basically because the grandparents were getting old, and I knew that things were going to happen. They would be passing on, and I would have to be involved because I was the one son I was sort of the responsible son.
Uh-huh.
If you're familiar with that dynamic in families. So I knew that I had to be here to be around whatever was going to happen. And the grandparents died in the early 90s, and I expected that. But then my father died suddenly in 1996. He was only 72 at the time, I believe. And that was totally unexpected. And then all of a sudden, my two brothers and I became responsible for my mother's care. And then within about 6 months, well, it was about 9 months following that, I basically, situations happened where I really figured out what was going on.
Yeah.
I understood all the things that I'd never understood before, basically due to circumstances where I had to be directly involved.
Yeah. Dr. Major, is there, in fact, much literature that is available that is written for the families of someone with mental illness, and should they go through maybe a training period if this is necessary?
Not only are there writings, there's actually a journal that comes out now probably 4 or 5 times a year entitled Schizophrenia. Usually, it's got a logo on it, SZ. And there are several organizations. One is the National Organization for the Mentally Ill.
NAMI.
NAMI.
Yeah.
So there's plenty of literature and research that addresses the kinds of disturbances that go on.
But how well does a profession understand what is happening? And do you really expect that these are going to be your partners in trying to help someone through these difficult times?
Well, imagine all the issues that people have interpersonally who don't have schizophrenia. They occur equally with someone who has schizophrenia. But if those issues are written off because they're crazy and they're not understandable, then they can't even hope to have those issues addressed, the needs, aspirations, wishes, frustrations. They get written off. If they're even referred to in a disturbed way, then no one would even try to understand.
Mm-hmm. What is the point that most people have trouble dealing with then, if you've got a schizophrenic person in the family?
I think there's the issue of the biology of the illness.
Exactly.
A couple of things. There are the interventions that are required that will allow people to be able to think more clearly, function in tune with themselves more clearly. So medications are certainly one aspect of the treatment. But then addressing the issues that are involve talk therapies, which are getting less attention, but they've always been at the fore. Helping the patient with schizophrenia to understand themselves, which would be a talk therapy so that they can be perform better in a relationship, but also involve and include the family, which was at the main in the mainstream 50 years ago and is less of a concern because we consider schizophrenia a biological disease and it's narrowed to be an illness with a biological treatment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that is the main point that I did not understand this, and I know my family did not understand this, and that is that it is a biological disease, that it has, while we may not know the exact nature of it, we do understand that part of it. But my family was not clear on that. We did not understand that. And until I got that, until I understood that point, that my mother had a physical illness, it was, as I understand it, it's primarily a brain chemistry question.
Yeah. And how well do we understand all of that? I see constantly there's more experimentation and more information coming out.
The complexity is that schizophrenia isn't one thing. Just as people with dementia, as you were hearing earlier in the show, dementia doesn't affect everybody the same way. Different parts of the brain are disturbed. Some people have motor difficulties more than others. Memory difficulties are prominent, but all kinds of other thinking disorders occur that are complicated. Schizophrenia has many different presentations. Mm-hmm. And
Which my mother is a good example, because her people are familiar with the paranoid schizophrenic. That seems to be, I think, the most common, or at least it's the one that people hear about.
Yes.
More so. But my mother was a disorganized schizophrenic, so that's a much.
Is that what it's actually called, disorganized schizophrenia?
That's the term. Trying to separate out patients into groups that allow for individual management is certainly the task in psychiatry and medicine, try to individualize people but put them into defined groups. I would say 30 years ago, you could look in the literature and find 30 or 40 different types of schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. And in the latest compendium, we have paranoid and catatonic and disorganized as typical characteristics. Mm-hmm. So more simple definitions. And each of these types, of course, are colored by the kinds of personality, mm-hmm. kinds of education, kinds of interpersonal style and skills that you have.
So in a way, the schizophrenic individual is blending it in a way for themselves and expressing it in some way that nobody else would, but it is a kind of a volitional thing.
They have disturbances in perception. They may have an experience that you might have as a dream and recognize as a dream, and know it didn't really happen. They may have it and not be able to separate out, did it happen or didn't it happen? It's as real, even though it might have been a dream while you're awake.
Yeah.
You know, and then it gets incorporated in your behavior. You then treat somebody. You had a personal experience. We have this in real life. You have an experience during a dream, and then you treat somebody as if they were unfaithful to you because they were unfaithful to you in the dream, and now you're mad at them in the morning.
Right.
Well, a special edition of Off the Page, and we are speaking right now with Dave Elder about his book, Expecting the Broken Brain to Do Mental Push-Ups, and also with Dr. Edward Major, and we are not doing phone calls or emails on this program today. There are, however, so many questions, and I think things that people are wondering about. You write in your book, Dave, about being part of the rock music scene mm-hmm. in California and also the drug scene that was going on around mm-hmm. you there, and you began to notice certain similarities mm-hmm. was it in the use of the drugs or the results of that, or when people got high, that you saw things that you might have also seen with your mother?
Well, that was actually later that I put it together. I took note of things going along, but I didn't make the connections until later on when I actually started to understand what was going on with my mother, and then I realized that there were some commonalities there. And the thing is, while we may not know the exact mechanics of schizophrenia, and it is, as Dr. Major suggested, it's very complicated what's actually going on in the brain. We do know that it is a physical illness and that it can be treated to some extent. You know, in my mother's case, it was with antipsychotic drugs. With people who are suffering from, like, clinical depression or bipolar disorder, there are antidepressants that can help to deal with that. So there are chemical problems going on in the brain, and you can take drugs to address chemical problems. And what I realized is that rock musicians, a lot of them, were actually taking drugs probably as they were self-medicating. And, I mean, I do know the backstory, you know, being involved with as a musician. There are people who I know who know people. And I'm not going to, you know, I wouldn't.
You don't have to name names. Yeah, you don't right, in your right, book. But if right, you want to yeah, tell us just what is the conditions that lead them to this, because I suppose in a way it mm-hmm, fashionable.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, there are at least two or three people who I know of for sure who are bipolar. And I talk about Kurt Cobain in my book because he's one person who, you know, now that he was
a real, you know, right, pop rock star who, right, it right, seems from what you write in your book, really descended mm-hmm, into mm-hmm, depression.
Right. Well, he was bipolar. You know, that's not in question. That's an actual yeah, fact. And there was this strange connection, which I mentioned in the book, between his story and my own. Just a weird little thing that happened. But what he was expressing, when he attempted suicide about a month or two before he actually did commit suicide, but what he was expressing then, he was on the depressive end of bipolar disorder. And so what he was saying is what someone will feel like when they're in that position. And it's a physical feeling. It's not the central thing that I talk about in what I mean by the title of the book.
Mm. Expecting the broken brain to do mental push-ups. Mm-hmm. Quite a title. Yeah. What does it mean now?
Well, the idea that I'm getting at there is that if you think that a person has control over their brain, which is the way we ordinarily think of the brain, then you look at somebody like Kurt Cobain and you're like, come on, snap out of it. What is your problem?
You think that you could use this as a creative element in his music, that he could do something
sure,
with it.
Yeah.
That
yeah,
genius is next to madness, I think, is the old cliche yeah, about this. But yeah, it doesn't work that way.
Well, I mentioned in the book that at the time I really didn't have any sympathy for him, you know, and I'm hearing about his story, and my reaction to it was, what's your problem? Just snap out of it, you know. Just.
Why don't you be happy?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's like, okay. So you were feeling sad for a while, but you know, it's like, and then having an experience later on with someone who had clinical depression, I came to understand that the person doesn't have control over that. That's the point. And the image that she used to me was, well, it's like having a broken arm, except that it's inside your head. So it's like you
can do one-armed push-ups. There are such things, but most people really could not do that. But you're expecting, right, if you want to get somebody just to come out of a schizophrenic mm-hmm, episode, that
right,
they're not going to be able to do these push-ups.
Right, because mm-hmm, as Dr. Matre said, they're having a very real experience in their mind, but to you, because you're the observer and you don't, unless you understand that, then you don't, yeah, you know, they're just acting crazy, as he said. We're used to thinking of people as having control over their brains because in general we do, but people who have schizophrenia or people with clinical depression or people with bipolar disorder, their brains are controlling them at times.
Yeah. I think we need to clarify something here, Dr. Matre. Schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, is that the same thing, just the same same words for something?
There are two different classifications of disturbances, and yet there's a lot of research that suggests in some people that there may be some commonality. And we see family trees where we have clearly some individuals who we would diagnose as bipolar, having episodes of mania and episodes of depression, and then other individuals who we identify as having schizophrenia, disturbances of thought, mm-hmm, not mood. Yeah. And so we begin to look and see what's similar. How are these different individuals manifesting, you know, behaviors and experiences that are different from other family members, but yet maybe having some commonality in the genetics or origins.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's still up for a lot of research.
Oh, of course. Something else that I read about in your book, Dave, that really did surprise me a little bit, and that is that there will be maybe a triggering incident that will send someone into schizophrenia, and that in your mother's case, it was having a third child, which I don't know if you could warn somebody, don't have three children, or, you know, is this?
That was the surprise, of course. You know, she had two other children, and I don't know what it's like having a child, but I do know that it's very stressful.
Well, there is, you know, rather common, I suppose, postpartum depression, and that I suppose this is something that medical science is ready for, and, you know, the OBGYN will counsel a woman on this, that this is something that might happen.
Well, not every pregnancy is the same.
Oh, of
course. People can have several children, and one of them, they end up having eclampsia with severe hypertension and all kinds of metabolic disturbances. So this woman has a living thing inside, and some of those hormones and things are exchanged both ways. Aside from that.
Yeah.
There are episodes of postpartum depression and postpartum psychoses. They're different. These are different kinds of conditions that occur after delivery.
Yeah, but what I'm wondering is, it sounds like the trigger could be almost anything, and that if a person is susceptible to this, they want to live a quiet life, and so they're, you know, sitting out in the backyard on a beautiful day, and all of a sudden 50 crows fly into the backyard, and that sets something off. There's no way you can control that.
But again, what is a trauma for one person may not be a trauma for someone else. These are very personalized. I wouldn't particularly be concerned about crows, but somebody else might be deathly afraid of birds.
Yeah.
And so what is the personal thing? Every cardiologist knows that he has patients that may have some underlying potential for heart disease, but they're in a stress of a divorce or somebody's death in the family, and all of a sudden their cholesterol goes up, arteries get occluded, and they have a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And they do well until there's another with treatment, until there's another crisis.
But it does make it sound like life is risky.
Hey, we can be in vulnerable situations to be laid low by whatever our particular weaknesses are.
Yeah. Dave, the book is dedicated to and tells a lot about a woman that you just referred to as M.
Right.
But apparently someone that you were very close to.
Yes.
And I am just wondering how it turns out that a person whose mother was schizophrenic suddenly also met somebody else who later discovered had that same difficulty. And it does not make for an easy relationship, but it certainly gave you context.
It could be just that was part of the attraction, that, you know, that something – I mean, it's I had thought about this actually – My younger brother, there were three of us. My younger brother actually married someone who she has some anxiety disorder. You know, I don't know. I don't know the details on that. I don't know her diagnosis. Yeah. But I thought, you know, it may have something to do with that this is the kind of woman who attracts us.
How about my suggestion that you are tolerant of someone who has those things instead of being averse to it?
Right.
Because you've had some experience and say, I can handle this. Here's a good person. They happen to have these issues, but I can handle that.
Right, yeah, that it doesn't...
Not an issue. It doesn't put you off.
Right.
Because you have some experience.
Right, and it may just be something that's intuitive. You know, there are a lot of things going on with attraction to another person that we don't understand. They're just purely, you know, and some of them are biological, but we don't understand.
There's a lot of chemistry in here, more ways than one.
Right, exactly.
Wow. We've only got about a minute. Can you give any sort of advice about people taking care of themselves and not having to...
I think the advantage of having a scientific community is if you recognize that there are people in the family who have diabetes, heart disease, and mental illnesses, that you can begin to look at your children, look at your siblings and say, you deserve to have your eyes open. Seek help rather than denial and let things fester, get worse until there's great disturbance in interpersonal relationships. Once you break your ties with people, you don't have that support to be able to deal with your inner problems.
Well, very, very practical advice and very good advice. The book is called Expecting the Broken Brain to Do Mental Push-Ups. It is self-published by its author, Dave Elder. Earlier, we spoke with Martha Stettinius about her book, Inside the Dementia Epidemic, published by Dundee Lakemont Press. And you can find more information about these books, including how to order a copy, by checking our website at wskg.org. Click on radio and then on the off-the-page listing. Also on the web, you can listen again to this and other off-the-page programs in our audio archive. It's wskg.org. Well, this past hour has been so filled with good information about our well-being, and our thanks to Dave Elder and to Dr. Ted Major for joining us here today.
And thank you.
Thank you.
Off the Page returns 2 weeks from today when we delve into American history, forestry and farming, cemeteries, attitudes about life and nature, the artistic origins of the environmental movement. It all figures in an impressive essay by Aaron Sachs, Associate Professor of History and American Studies at Cornell. The book is called Arcadian America. It is set mostly in the 19th century when this nation was just finding its way. Aaron Sachs, and your feelings about our natural world, Arcadian America, Tuesday, February 19th, live at 1, rebroadcast at 7. Audio engineer today was Sarah Gager. I'm Bill Jaker. Thank you for joining us Off the Page.